This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
There is a conversation in society about migration generally. Sometimes it can spill over into more aggressive rhetoric, and we have to always be careful about this. We have signed international obligations to support asylum and refugees. These are long-standing commitments this country has made, but we do need to have a system that works, and I think this government is focused on that.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, we discovered one council was having major issues with staffing costs, another made a power play on the future of local government, and the struggle around special educational support in schools was highlighted. I'm Senior News Editor Nikki White, standing in for regular host Simon Finlay, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
Our special guest today is Chatham and Aylesford MP Tristan Osborne. So Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
Lucky me, I've had my head deep in Thanet District Council's financial outturn documents, looking at the rate of absence in their waste services, of all things.
Is there something special about that?
Surprisingly so. So Thanet District Council's report says that in the 2024 to 25 financial year, that council overspent by 1.3 million on its waste and cleaning services, and that about a million of that was due to what it describes as, quote, higher than historical and industry average rates of sickness absence. So essentially, staff in that department seemed to take quite a lot of sick days, and as such, the councils ended up dependent on expensive agents. Staff to plug those gaps.
So why is it concentrated in that department, and what's the council planning to do about it?
So nobody would give me any specific ideas as to why the waste department has it worse than others on this, but the council said at least part of it is to do with the fact that it's difficult manual work and higher than absent, because it includes bin men, so higher than average rates of absence would be expected there. TDC says that, you know, more efficient processes are in place to deal with absences and the like, and that they're recruiting a human resources manager from the cleansing budget to try and manage this kind of thing more effectively and depend less on agency staff in future.
Thanks, Dan. So, Robert, what's been going on in Medway?
Medway Council published their preferred option for the upcoming local government reorganisation, and which they suggested would see four unitary authorities across the county, and was designed, they said, around the existing boundaries of health and care partnerships and the boundaries created by motorways, for example. Council leader Vince Maple said it's the option which best aligns with the government's requirements for around 250,000 people per unitary.
But some people aren't happy with this, are they?
No. Reorganisation is always going to be a can of worms, and the borders which Medway have set out would split a few existing wards in two. Matt Borton, who's the leader of Tunbridge and Moreland Council, called Medway's publishing of the map, quote, appalling and disrespectful, and took particular issue with the North Kent unitary peeling away Bluebell Hill and Walderslade from the rest of what would be its former council, which would be in the West Kent authority. There was also criticism from within Medway, with leader of the opposition group of the Tories, Councillor George Perfect, said his group vehemently disagreed with the map and said there had not been cooperation between the administration and other council leaders.
So what happens now? Are there other options?
There are other options. Confusingly, last month, KCC had a report which said it preferred a three-council option for the county. But this week, the authority's reform leader, Lynan Kemkaran, has said she prefers a single council which covers the entirety of Kent. As is always the case with redrawing boundaries, there will be people who are unhappy with the changes. But there are technically no limits to how many options can be submitted to the government in November. Once submitted, the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government will review the options and make a decision.
OK, thanks, Rob.
So, Nikki, is there much going on with our MPs this week?
Well, one issue which crops up time and time again is the lack of educational provision for children with special needs, and that's been back in the spotlight again in the past week. It isn't good news, unfortunately. A new SEND school was due to open at the former Birchwood Community Primary School site in Swanley in September 2026, but we're now being told that's been pushed back by up to 3 years. Now, the idea was first submitted to the Department for Education by KCC in autumn 2022, and that was given the go-ahead a year later. The Lee Academies Trust, it's a trust that already runs a number of special special schools across the county, including Milestone in New Ash Green and Snowfields in Maidstone. They were going to run it. Now, however, it's now emerged it may not open until 2028 or even 2029, after KCC admitted that the government's original timescales were, as it describes, overly ambitious.
So what's the problem?
Well, the Trust has said it's tried to get some sort of clarification from the DfE on several occasions about when this new school will be developed, but it has yet to receive a satisfactory response. We also tried the DfE for a comment and haven't heard back.
That must be pretty frustrating for everyone involved, especially the parents.
Yeah, it must be. I mean, we're talking about places for 250 children, so that's many, many parents who are now battling over fewer spaces, and it's not really a headache you need when you're already dealing with the day-to-day battles of a child with additional needs. Now, Sevenoaks MP and former Government Minister Laura Trott, she's been keeping close tabs on it all, and she's described the delay as very disappointing. She says she's doing all she can to get this project moving and has written to both KCC and the Department for Education, asking for everything to be done to ensure a 2027 opening or 2028 at the latest. Now, KCC has said the new special school in Swanley is an integral part of its SEND programme, but it's waiting for the government to appoint a technical team, start some feasibility studies and provide a formal project plan. However, it did say that while they're waiting for all that to happen, KCC officers are continuing to prepare the site to ensure things can progress quickly once all the boxes have been ticked. Now, they say the additional delays may also be linked to the government's anticipated reform of SEND, which is going to be announced later this year. However, in better news, there's work underway at two other schools to increase capacity. Two consultations have opened on proposals to increase the number of SEND places from 120 to 192 at Parkwood Hall Co-op Academy in Swanley, and from 190 to 318 at Broomhill Bank in Hextable. So, subject to those being approved, there is some light at the end of the tunnel.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
A long-standing Medway councillor, cabinet member and candidate for Kent Police and Crime Commissioner, today's guest is no stranger to the headlines. Now in his second year as the Member of Parliament for Chatham and Aylesford, we welcome back to the podcast Tristan Osborne.
Very welcome to be here. I think the second time in the last 12 months, but always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, as you say, it's just been over a year since we last spoke with you. What have you been up to since then? What have you achieved?
Well, look, it's been a busy year. So from getting my office set up to getting my team in place to support the constituency and the residents, we've dealt with thousands of bits of casework. I've been contributing in Parliament to a number of different debates, everything from the tobacco and vapes bill, where I've been working to increase that age to improve our health locally, to dealing with fly tipping, challenging on court weights, and of course, lots of national policies as well. It has been a very busy 12 months. And plans are it's going to be a very busy 12 months coming up too.
How does it feel now? Do you feel like you've gotten your feet under the desk? You've moved into the role well now?
Well, I'm not complacent. There's never a part of this journey which you can't learn from. I do feel now I've got my office in place. We're dealing with constituency casework. That's really good, because I think when you initially get in and you don't have anyone around you, that's always a bit of a concern initially, especially with expectations. I also think we're getting into, policies. We're in the delivery phase of government now. We're only a year in. Some of those are popular. Some are more contentious. I'm enjoying the role. I think there was a tiny bit of when you walk into Parliament, you kind of have imposter syndrome. You know, because I've been a teacher previously and I was like, am I actually an MP? I am. And it takes a bit of time just to sort of get around that, actually. Mm. It's a bit strange, especially if you weren't necessarily planning for that.
Yeah. One of the things you've been involved with is Kent Online's Blue Badge Battle campaign, which is seeking to make the rules fairer for people with time-limited illnesses. Why do you think that's important? Why have you supported it?
Yeah, so several reasons. First of all, I think Kent Messenger does great campaigns, first of all. And looking at the track record going back in time, which I've supported. And this one is one of those examples of a great campaign, because it's dealing with real world problems that that impact actual people in Kent. And there are a number of constituents that I know Kent Messenger's reached out to that I've met individually, both in Parliament and in their own homes, where this impacts. And let me be specific about it. If someone comes out of hospital with a time limited condition, be that a broken bone or someone with cancer, something which might not require a 3-year or a year parking restrictions to be lifted. I think it is fair that we deal with people as individuals and we look at their conditions on, and even if that is on a time limited basis. So I've been really happy to see this is cross party across all MPs in Kent. It's been a real effort from us all. We need to do a bit more work now over the next 12 months to get it across to senior parliamentarians and ministers. But I know that work is ongoing.
As you say, this campaign, we're great, very grateful that it's received support across the parties from all of Kent's MPs, regardless of political affiliation. Why is it that something like this, we see sort of political cooperation, but on other matters, we see so much political point scoring? Why is it that there is that? Is it a case of sort of being concocted for the media and secretly behind all closed doors you're all good friends?
So a lot of, and this is the same in the council actually, if you watch the meetings, a lot of the policies that we put forward, there is agreement. Mm. Of course, that doesn't generate the interest so much unless it's an area of contention outside of the council chamber. And the same in Parliament. You know, you work with colleagues, you have friends that are in different political parties, you might be in agreement, for instance, on assisted dying legislation, where I have taken a position to support that, and that will be a non-whipped vote. And so there will be relationships you will build. And the example of that is the blue badge work we have just done, as you rightly said, with Helen Grant leading on that as an experienced MP. I've been able to work with her and partner with her on this type of stuff. So it is correct. We do live in an adversarial political system. We have, that is our dynamic in this country. And of course, politics will in many cases accentuate the political differences between the parties, and that debate actually is a healthy thing. So I'm not always averse to a bit of back and forth. I think that is what British democracy actually has been proudly doing for centuries, and I don't see that changing. Hmm. I do understand though that a lot of people think it's it can be perceived as being a bit immature, a bit yaboo, you know, people hurling insults at each other, and I always try and step back from any personal slights to keep it about the policies.
So something quite topical. Yesterday, the High Court made a very important ruling on the controversial Bell Hotel in Epping, issuing a temporary injunction and blocking the housing of asylum seekers there. Obviously, the government still has a legal responsibility to house asylum seekers, and now is understandably quite concerned that this could lead to other local authorities across the UK following their lead and trying to use this legal precedent to stop continued use of hotels for the housing of asylum seekers in their jurisdiction. How do you see this playing out, and do you think there's a risk of protests like the ones we've seen in Epping spreading to elsewhere in the country as a result?
Yeah, so the ruling made just yesterday, I think the Home Office will be looking at that very closely, because it will need to look at the technicalities of that legal judgment, which were specifically around the planning issue and whether they have permission to locate there. This is a long-standing issue. It's been going on for many years, conversations about the legal aspects to that site. I suspect the Home Office will need to look at different options around where we now house asylum seekers. I suspect that is the process which is happening today, and it will be ongoing. I'm a backbencher, so of course I'm not privy to access to those options, but I think the judgment, now it's been made, I think other council areas will see how they respond to this. I suspect some other councils may be looking at their legal positions as well. Some councils, of course, some of these asylum hotels may have gone through a planning process, in which case that legal judgment doesn't really matter to them. In other cases, it might not. So it does depend on the location, but you are correct. We're going to have to take that legal judgment, study it very closely. We do have to house asylum seekers, so this does need to be, we do need to find accommodation for these people. Yes.
Do you think it will actually successfully, even if hotels, the government is committed to stopping the use of hotels for this purpose. Do you think even if somehow the government manages to do that overnight, it will in any way diffuse the political tension which has been allowed to accumulate around the issue of immigration? Because surely the problem is, people don't have some abstract opposition to, holiday inns being used for this purpose. It's because they don't think asylum seekers should be in the country. Do you think this, even ending the use of hotels, do you think it will actually achieve what it's set out to?
Yeah, so there's a wider conversation about migration in general. So net migration is down by 50% under this government. Asylum claims are also down as well. And work visas are net significantly down on the last government. So actually migration is falling in this country. But you are right, the narrative that we read in the newspapers and on social media is tending to lead towards concern. And people are rightly raising the fact that some of those people housed are doing so in hotels. And we have pledged as a government to say that we will be removing, reducing the numbers in hotels over the course of this parliament. And just to say, there were 52,000 in hotels in the last government at its peak. We're now on about 36,000. And that number's due to go down as well. But how we house asylum seekers, well, we need the asylum system to be working better, to process people more quickly. That's another legacy that we are improving upon. And what you should see over the next, of course, the parliamentary term, is the number of asylum applications, the time taken to process asylum applications will go down, which means we need to use net less accommodation. But then there's a whole question about what happens when they get through the asylum system, when they become refugees, which are legally recognised. Where are those people housed, etc.? So there is a conversation in society about migration generally. Sometimes it can spill over into more aggressive rhetoric, and we have to always be careful about this. We have signed international obligations to support asylum and refugees. These are long-standing commitments this country has made. But we do need to have a system that works, and I think this government is focused on that. And just lastly, we are looking, not only have we signed agreements with France recently to return, but just yesterday with Iraq as well, which is one of the top 10 countries where we get asylum seekers from. So this isn't just about looking at our asylum processes, but also how we return people to their countries of origin in a quick and swift fashion. And that is a piece of work which is very seriously going on behind the scenes, but is not always commented upon by the media and others as well. So it's a very nuanced debate. I don't think migration is going to be off of the agenda, and I welcome the conversation on it. And I think people need to have this serious conversation as well.
You mentioned there around the perception of the government and the way people view these issues, and sort of maybe sometimes the myth doesn't match up to the reality of things. I notice on social media, you're quite straightforward in telling people, making clear that, you know, for example, a recent one was about the levels of crime and crime dropping. But I'm sure you know, people will respond and say, you're not living where I'm living and all this sort of thing. You're not afraid to sort of make the case about, as you've used the phrase, right-wing doomsters often in relation to the economy as well.
In relation to the economy, yes.
But the thing is, we see in these opinion polls that the government is viewed quite unfavourably at the moment. How do you explain this? Is it a problem with the government's messaging, or people just aren't very happy, or proposed change not being delivered?
So you are right. So on social media, specifically, like I try and use empirical evidence data to show trends and actually have a debate with people there about where we're heading as a country. I think that's quite sensible. As someone in backbench role like myself, it's really healthy to have that conversation. So when it comes to crime numbers, for instance, you're absolutely right. There's a long-term trend of crime falling. This isn't just under this government, under the last two as well. But the reality in people's lives is different. And the reason for that is because of their perception. So shoplifting might have been witnessed, but it might be one crime, but it might be witnessed by 20 people in a shop. That's still just one crime, but it has 20 witnesses. Similarly, burglary, which has gone down significantly, only impacts maybe a smaller number of people directly. So antisocial behaviour is another good example of that. Graffiti, 100 people might walk past every day, but yet is only one crime. Same with fly tipping. So the government has to do more in terms of how we deal with antisocial behaviour, shoplifting, etc. And I completely acknowledge that, which is the reason why we're looking at different court processes and restorative justice approaches. But the comment that I find, I think, disingenuous is this idea that we're living in an unsafe society, that people should fear walking along their roads every single night. And that I want to challenge, because, you know, I work in London and I think it's a very safe and pleasant place to socialise, to go out, to work. And I don't see the same lived experience that I have. Now, I completely accept that anecdote, other people will experience differently. So more work to do. Where I think the government is getting it wrong and right, look, we're 1 year into government. Governments are never, when they're making difficult decisions, when they're engaging in change, they absolutely, you know, and we see this in all polling. Look at the United States. Donald Trump only got in January. His polling numbers are falling as well. So that is standard in Western democracies. Tony Blair was maybe an outlier on on that, but actually that's not uncommon. I think what we need to do is be delivering on these policies. We need the economy to be recovering. We need to deliver our falling waiting lists. We need to build 1.5 million new homes. We need to have an immigration system which is working and processing people fairly. And then lastly, we need good schools for young people and the cost of living crisis for people to be feeling more money in their pockets. And we're 1 year in, and I think people are frustrated that that change hasn't happened quick enough. So I'm not pessimistic. I'm permanently optimistic in many ways. And I do think that at the end of our 5 years, people will be able to make a judgment on our success. But I understand people's frustrations, especially if the pace of change isn't where their expectations are.
Just the other week, it was quite a big story. We saw literally hundreds of people in one day arrested under terrorism legislation for attending a peaceful protest in support of Palestine Action, which your party in government has prescribed as a terror organisation. Do you agree with the prescription? Do you think, is it not just criminalising protest?
So it was a cross-party. The Conservatives and others also supported a prescription. So that's one of those things where we have actually largely agreed across parties that this is the case. Look, Palestine Action is a protest group. There are many other protest groups, Palestinian Solidarity Campaign and others, that are peacefully engaged in protest. And we live in a democracy, and I fully respect the rights of people to protest. With prescription, however, there will have needed to have been a significant evidence base to suggest that these groups were engaged in illegal activities. Now, I don't know the complete details of those because the security minister will, but as I understand it, there have been threats of violence, there has been training of people on targeting specific individuals, and we know there's been criminal damage on military bases as well. So I'm not denuding the fact that people absolutely should be supporting whatever campaigns they feel they can. Palestinians, there are many groups that do so peacefully, and we should respect those, and people can fly as many placards or say how they feel with those groups. But when you have groups that are doing that type of activity, that is where the concern stems from. So by all means, people listening, please go and protest peacefully and legally. But if you do go and protest on behalf of prescribed groups which have that type of background to them, you need to be aware that the law is clear on this.
But surely, you know, the images we saw coming out of that protest the other week of elderly, retired pensioners at a protest holding up signs saying that they oppose are having any involvement in a foreign conflict and support an organisation which takes direct steps to, and what they perceive to be legitimate direct steps to stop that. And the images of you know, elderly protesters being dragged away by the police and legally treated as if they are akin to members of Hizb ut-Tahrir or al-Shabaab or something like that. That is, surely any person would recognise that to be ludicrous, and it will degrade faith in terror legislation if you can be treated as a terrorist for expressing that kind of view at a protest, the same way that somebody would try to recruit members to Boko Haram or something. Do you not worry it will degrade people's faith in national security legislation?
Well, I'm not going to make comparisons with those organisations because every organisation will have different sets of criteria applied to them, and obviously that will be subject to prescription and etc. However, with prescription, we weren't just prescribing Palestine Action on that day either. Parliament also prescribed two far-right organisations which had similar violent intentions and illegal activity behind them. So with this prescription, there will have needed to have been a high threshold of evidence to suggest that they had either committed illegal activity, that they were engaged in behaviours of targeting individuals potentially for violent activity. Again, this is all in the public domain, and there might have also been, and this is in the Times commentary 2 weeks ago, so I'm just saying again what they were saying, connections with other hostile states in terms of funding. Now, again, if that is happening, the government does have to make serious decisions about that. I am not denuding the fact that people, however old they are, when they're getting arrested, it's a horrible experience. And I don't want to see people arrested for expressing freedom of speech, which is the reason why there are a lot of other groups, Palestinian Solidarity Campaign and others, which are articulating people's views on this issue in a peaceful way with groups that don't have those connections. And so I'm not reneging on the fact I don't like seeing things happening on our, old people being arrested or young people being arrested, but we have to also respect that some of these groups have ill intent, and that is the reason why they were prescribed.
Since coming into Parliament, I mean, obviously you've been in politics for a long, long time, and you have stood for Parliament before, and now you're in. Do you see sort of, has your view changed of politics since you've gone to that other side? Now you're in the Palace of Westminster, you're in the seat of, you're in government as well, your party's in government. Do you see political issues differently now and see what possibilities there are?
Have I? Yes. I was elected at a very young age, at 28. Mm. I think it was like an eon ago now, actually. I'm now 42, so 14 years ago. I think when I got in, I felt three things. I felt that I could change the world, which actually, in some ways, is a bit naive, because you then realise you've got a lot of stakeholders you have to work with, and sometimes when you're in opposition, you don't have the decision-making to do that. So you immediately get to that frustration point. I also feel that I was probably, even though you might say I'm a bit partisan and strong-willed, I used to be a lot more so. I think I've mellowed out quite a bit. I now am much more open to working with people in a sort of more relaxed style. And I also realise that some of these policy challenges are not going to be cured overnight. You know, I might at 28 have thought, if I just stick three cameras on Luton Road, as an example, which is one of my first ever campaigns, to put CCTV cameras there, it would immediately resolve in a lower crime level. Mm. And that's not true. There are a lot more complexities to the reason why communities are deprived, and housing issues and lack of access to services. So I think I've just become a bit more mature and well-rounded, I like to think. But of course, other people will say differently, tend to be political opponents of mine, and that's absolutely fine. But I think you do mature in this role. Mm. I think I've still got more to offer. I look forward to that over the next 4 years or however many years I have, depending on the electorate. And look, this role is an honour, and I love every day, and I try and make that difference every day. Mm. But I also know that, you know, I've still got that positive attitude, but I also know I have to work with people to deliver some of this.
Has there been anything that's really surprised you about, once you became an MP, about the role?
Several things. I think firstly, as a backbench MP, I have less decision-making power than I did as a councillor, as a cabinet member. So as cabinet member, I could do things like school streets, red routes. They're a bit controversial, but I was able to do something. Whereas a backbench MP, you have the power of the pulpit, but that's it.
Right.
Okay, so you actually can't pull the levers anymore. You don't have an officer team that reports to you. And you're not, so in some senses, you're divorced of the decision-making. You're a stakeholder rather than a participant. Mm. Second of all, I think MPs, I think with the dawn of social media, I think it's a lot more, there's a lot more intense focus on you. You can see this in my social media. Mm. Once upon a time, I might have got 10 retweets. Now I'm getting hundreds and thousands and whatever. There's just a lot more of a focus. And that can be born in a healthy way, but also in some of the abuse, especially directed towards female MPs, I think is certainly there. And then thirdly, what surprised me is just how Parliament works, actually. I taught this subject as a teacher, and getting in there and actually seeing that it is a human system. Right. It has its historical quirks. It sometimes is madness, some of the protocol, some of the deference, some of the wigs, some of the costumes, the hours are strange as well. So there's just like quirks like that, which are like, wow, where's this? Who designed this? But it's a product of our history as a country, which is both inspiring, but also slightly frustrating at times.
Mm. If you could have sort of, in the early hours of July 5th last year, taken yourself aside after you knew you'd won, and giving yourself a piece of advice that, from your experience that you've learned since, what would that be?
Oh, goodness, that is a really sharp question, isn't it? Work with colleagues across party earlier on some of the shared campaign work. Mm. So, and also learn how the place works early on, as in read up on it, understand what these things mean. I think there's been a bit of a voyage of discovery, which I probably could have done more quickly, but that's in hindsight, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the training by Parliament has been excellent, so I can't complain about that. It's just whether or not I could have done more homework walking in September. But I think every MP has the same experience. You feel like when you walk in the first day, it's like a new school, it's like a college opening, university, freshers. I mean, it's not the same, but it still has that vibe about it. And you all kind of, because we had such a large new intake as well, the one advantage is you've been able to learn from others' mistakes and etc. But if I could go back, I would say, you know, last summer, instead of relaxing after four, maybe you should have done a bit more homework going in, so you could have, you know, maybe get your name in lights a bit earlier or started those campaigns quicker. But look, I mean, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Tristan Osborne, MP, thank you for taking the time to speak to us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
The subject of asylum seekers being housed in hotels is back in the headlines again this week after a High Court ruling. On Tuesday, Epping Forest District Council was granted a temporary injunction blocking asylum seekers from being housed at the Bell Hotel in the Essex town. Ministers are now said to be looking at a range of different contingency options, according to Security Minister Dan Jarvis. It's an incredibly complex issue, Dan. What are your thoughts?
So I think for starters, obviously, like you said, it's local council which has sought this temporary injunction and been granted it. And around the country, it's lower tier local councils which have responsibility for housing asylum seekers and that sort of thing when they end up in their jurisdiction. So the fact that clearly there's a legal basis on which councils can try to refuse this kind of thing happening means that realistically it will end up politically split. Reform and maybe Tory run district councils around the country are probably going to start looking into trying to employ this legal precedent to avoid, to end the use of current asylum hotels in their jurisdiction and prevent the future use. And I think Richard Tice was saying just this week that he expects all reform-run councils to do that. But also, secondly, I don't think it'll actually help stem the tension which is arising, with protests around these hotels and things. Obviously, hotels are large and symbolic and usually in relatively central areas, and that's why they've garnered so much tension. But, legally, local councils still have a responsibility to house asylum seekers. And if the court tells them you can't house them in hotels or whatever, they'll have to find other places for them. And it'll be council housing, it'll be HMOs from private landlords. It's quite a big business for private landlords taking money from local councils to house homeless people, asylum seekers, that kind of thing. And essentially what it means is that these people will be dispersed from places like hotels and into essentially regular residential neighbourhoods. And I don't really think that will be very popular or go very well, because part of the reason why people are as angry is not because they have some abstract moral opposition to the use of hotels for this purpose, but because they basically don't want asylum seekers in the country. And if they're moved from hotels to regular residential roads, that's not going to change.
Yeah, it's just shifting things somewhere else, isn't it? What about you, Robert? What do you think?
Well, I think it's exactly that. This whole issue has been sort of about shifting blame. And I mean, I think the thing that quite worries me is the extent of misinformation that plays a role in this and sort of the amplification that certain politicians are willing to do. I saw a clip the other day which was of a protest outside of a hotel, and this guy was shouting at the police that basically he knew, based upon what he had read online, that inside the hotel there were categorically members of ISIS who were planning to go round to the local school and behead the children. And he was obviously very upset and worried about this. And there's this whole sort of mythos around the hotels of a lot. You look online and people say that it's 4-star hotels and they're basically being put up in the Ritz and why aren't we looking after our own people and things like that. And certain politicians like Robert Jenrick went to a protest outside of one of these hotels recently. I think basically this asylum issue, a lot of politicians see a short-term gain in terms of particularly the Tories and Reform at the moment of making this a big issue for Labour, but aren't really putting forward a reasonable solution to this. This choice by a council is not a solution, because basically, as Dan says, either it will push it into HMOs. The best case scenario for them is it will push them elsewhere within the country. It's not going to stem the flow, and it's just going to make people angrier and angrier, and that's not really good for anybody.
No, not at all. From my point of view, it just really saddens me that some people think it's okay to stand outside what is effectively somebody's home and yell at them and tell them that they're not welcome here. I mean, many of the people who have been placed in these hotels are decent people. They're decent people fleeing the most horrific of conditions, and I think you'll find thousands of people in this country will sympathise with that. I mean, the most recent Home Office data shows that there were 32,345 asylum seekers being housed temporarily in UK hotels. Those figures are up until the end of March. And that was actually down 15% from the end of December. Now, there are new figures due out in between us recording this podcast and being published. And I'm guessing it will probably show a rise, and probably because it's people that are more likely to travel in the summer than they are in the winter. But whatever those numbers show, these people need our help. I mean, they're desperate, and we should be showing them some compassion. Many of them come here and they want to contribute to our society. They may not be able to do paid work, but many will be volunteering because they want to make a difference. Now, I'm not naive. Of course, there's going to be a criminal element amongst people, but that's just society. There's bad people in every walk of life. But if you're stuck in a hotel, you're miles from home, probably separated from your family, and then you've got people protesting outside telling you you're not welcome here, I mean, how would you feel? I mean, for me, the problem isn't about those seeking asylum. It's the time it's taking to process the application that's the issue. People, yes, they have a right to be angry about the amount of money being spent on hotels, but it's hardly the fault of the people that are being placed there. But it's an issue that we've talked about before, and it's an issue I'm sure we're going to be talking about time and time again. It's not an easy one. Okay, that's your lot for this week. My thanks to Dan and Robert for their contributions and to special guest Tristan Osborne MP. Next week, we'll be welcoming former Maidstone MP and Strictly Come Dancing sensation Anne Widdecombe, who'll be giving her no-nonsense views on the state of politics. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5pm. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5pm or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.